Life can be an extraordinary adventure. More than ordinary. In the gym. At home. At work. More than ordinary. Advice. Without the new agey bullshit.
Welcome to More Than Ordinary, presented by Seven Generation Games. I'm Maria Burns-Ortiz.
And I'm Anne Maria DeMars. And today we have with us a wonderful guest, like we always have a wonderful guest. And this one is a longtime friend of mine and our families, Ruddy Ferguson, Dr. Ruddy Ferguson, 2004 Olympian in judo and 100 kilograms, Howard University Hall of Famer in three sports, football, wrestling, and track. Also a PhD. Also, he was recently inducted into the Bahamian Hall of Fame for judo as a coach. So Ruddy has kind of done the gamut from success in sports, success academically, and he also, and this is what we're going to be talking about a lot today, has been pretty successful, I would say, as a family man. He's married with two children, and so one of the things we wanted to talk a lot about today was parenting. So hey, Ruddy, it's another U.S. team member / doctorate. We should form a club, huh?
Yes, thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate everything and mentioning of my accolades. But as you said before, one of the most important things that I've done and what I'm continuing to do is be a husband and be a father. And in June of this year, on the 30th, my wife and I will celebrate 15 years of marriage. And I'm sure that anybody who's listening knows that staying in the game for more than 10 years puts you definitely ahead of the curve. And when you're speaking about doing something more than ordinary, being married in today's society is definitely something that is extraordinary. To me, that's one of the major things that I've done in my life. And I think that's my highest calling, to be a husband and a father. So thanks for being on. I'm looking forward to speaking about parenting.
So one of the things I really wanted to talk about is you and I were talking the other day, and you have a son, Rufus, who is just a really fine young man. He's a judo player. He's smart. He's kind. He's polite. He's well-spoken. He's everything that you would want a child to be. And then I have a daughter, Julia, who is a few years older than Rufus. She's a freshman in college, and she is also smart and a good athlete and a kind heart. And we were talking about the differences in child rearing, given that Rufus is going to be like you. I can already tell. He's taller than me. When he's an adult, he's going to be a large African-American man. And Julia is a small, kind of blondish girl. And how those things, even though you have a PhD, your wife has an MD, you live in a nice neighborhood, just the fact of how he looks means that you feel like you need to raise him differently than I raised Julia. Is that an accurate summation?
Well, definitely. And I don't think it's as much as a race issue as much as it is an experience issue. My experiences in my life, they've warped and changed my views and thus my behavior. Some of the people in my peer group who make the type of money that I make and who have had the academic achievements that I've had haven't had the experiences that I've had with the police. I've been pulled over by the police. I've been thrown on the ground by the police. I've been held at gunpoint by the police. I've been harassed by the police. I've been jammed up against the wall by the police. Even had the police called on me twice at national level judo tournaments when I haven't even been the aggressor, because to be quite honestly, I don't have the option to be the aggressor. Case in point, when one of my friends asked me recently about how I would have responded if I was one of those passengers on that United flight who was asked to get off the flight, I said, I would have gotten off the flight because my life and the white supremacist system has taught me and inculcated me that I need to behave and act a certain way. But that being said, I really have to teach my son how to survive. My job as an African-American male is to give my son the survival tools so that he can make it through life, because one misstep or one evening when he makes a bad decision, it can give him a record and that can ruin his life. He doesn't have to die. He just has to be blamed for a thing.
So if he was Brock Turner, that white kid from Stanford that raped that girl, you're pretty certain that he wouldn't have got off with a warning in 3 months or whatever that kid got?
I don't believe so. I mean, we can never say what would happen unless we put that person in that situation. But from what I've seen in society, I don't think that it would be the same. We do know from the data that blacks and people of color get harsher sentencing. I mean, we know that. I also know that in my life that I've run circles around some of the counterparts in my industry and they get more things than I get, and I've done more than they do. And that's just what it is, and that's the life that I live in. And it's difficult to prepare my son for life by teaching him that things are not fair and that meritocracy does not apply to you and that you are going to have to do things 4 and 5 and 6 times better than some of your white counterparts. And if you don't do that, then you're not going to succeed. And it's difficult having that discussion with him. And he says, Daddy, well, it's not fair. I said, no, son, it's not fair. I said, but it is life, and it's the life that we live. And we live in a society right now where anti-intellectualism is rearing its ugly head, even to the office of the president. And the media cycle has shown us that if you're white and you're male and you're dumb, it's okay. Because as long as you're white and you're male, you're going to be all right. You see that from the heads of NFL teams, Major League Baseball teams. You see it in terms of companies, in terms of CEOs. We don't have enough women CEOs in companies. We have disparity in terms of income. And then when we look at just race, man, black folks make up only 12% of the population. They're in the minority. And they are treated as a minority. We are treated as a minority. And minorities don't have the same voice as a majority.
I had a discussion with one of my students about that. And I have almost never laid a hand on any of my children. And I really disagree with hitting kids. And she said, you can say that, but my son, and he's kind of like, he's about the size of your son, maybe a little, he's a couple years older now. So she said, my son is going to be growing up in a different society than your girls are. And she says, yes, I may take my hand to him from time to time. You know, I may take my belt off and whack him with it from time to time. But she says, what I am concerned about is that he will say the wrong thing and end up dead. And you don't have to have that same worry about your girls, that if he goes to Universal City Walk when I tell him not to, and he says the wrong thing, gives some lip to some police officer like he was given to me, and they shoot him. And then the next day in the newspaper, they're calling my little boy a thug. She said, you don't have to worry about that with your girls. And so, yes, maybe I take the strap to him from time to time, but it's out of love. And I didn't really have an answer to that.
I wrote my master's thesis on corporal punishment in the African-American community. And I use the analogy of pulling hair. And just like you talked about hitting, we don't really call it hitting as much as we call it encouragement or discipline. And if I pull your daughter's hair, she'll be upset. But if she was falling off of a cliff and I grabbed her by the hair and I was pulling her by her hair to bring her back up so that she had good footing, you would not look at my pulling her by the hair as being a bad thing. The pulling her by her hair in that particular situation is saving her from a situation like death. In the African-American community, sometimes we have to pull the hair of the children to save them from the thing that they may fall into. And if somebody just looks at the hair pulling, they'll say, oh, you shouldn't pull somebody's hair, but that's the incorrect thing to do. But we have to mentally future about what could possibly happen to our children and then put the steps in place to try to thwart or stop those particular things from happening. I mean, it is very difficult to talk to my son about don't put your hands on anything when you walk into a store, because he doesn't understand that sometimes people perceive him as stealing or that he's getting ready to steal. I remember when I walked into a 7-Eleven store with a young man by the name of Mark. I'll leave his last name out. When I was a young kid, and he shoplifted out of the store and he stole. I mean, that was something that was foreign to me. When I grew up, they said, if you lie, you steal. If you steal, you kill. If you kill, you go to jail. You go to jail, you go to hell. And that's what they taught us when we were coming up. And it was so foreign to me. When he stole the stuff and he showed it to me, I grabbed it out of his hand and I went back in the store and I put it on the counter. And I said, my friend took these things out of the store, sir. And then I walked back outside. I went back home and told my mom. She told me I couldn't play with Mark anymore. She said, because, honey, you'll be going to the store with him and he'll steal. She said, and your black ass will go to jail and he'll be out in the morning. My parents drink from a colored water fountain. And my mom got hit by the water hose in the 60s. And I try to tell people this because people think that Jim Crow and slavery and all those things were so long ago. And we're talking about one generational cycle. It's 2017 now. And in 1917, black folks were still being hung. As a matter of fact, I went to school at Howard University in Washington, D.C. In the D.C., Maryland, and Virginia area in 1911, there were more lynchings in that area than all of the United States. What people don't seem to realize is that they were still lynching black folks in the 70s and 80s. The only reason why you know about some of the things that happened with the police officers and black folks is because of social media. That's the only reason. It is commonplace to be around a group of black folks and for us to swap stories about how we've been mishandled and mistreated by the police. That's foreign conversation for white folks. They don't believe it happened. It's like when you tell white folks about what happens to you at the police, they think you're talking about the boogeyman or something. They cannot fathom, nor can they cognitively digest in their mind why white people with authority treat people of color like that. That is not commonplace for them. That's commonplace for me. I'm telling you, I said 2 years ago, I was at the Nationals, in the Scholastic Nationals for judo. And I just came off of a knee injury and I left my badge on the table because I was coaching my son and going over some grips. And I didn't want the badge, the corner of the badge, to hit him in his eye because he's smaller than I am. And that's right around eye level. I put the badge on the table and walked to the next mat. The people in USA Judo watched me set my badge down and walk to the next mat and then called the staff on me to put me out of the chair as I'm getting ready to coach my client. And then when I said, hey, sir, let me just finish coaching this match. And then I get up and go get my badge. Then they called security on me and then put the narrative out there that I was being belligerent.
Okay, I wanted to just back you up here. So people who don't know you like I do, they know that you're a very way calmer than me.
Dr. Emery, I don't have the privilege to get upset. I am 242 pounds. I'm stacked up like dirty clothes in the freshman dormitory. I have turtle shells on my neck for traps. I am a big and I'm very, very dark. I'm a big, very, very dark skinned dude. I got to smile more often than I like. And I have to speak low more often than I like speaking low because people feel threatened by me when they see me based upon the mental narrative that they have in their mind.
Right. And we had the exact same incident happen with a gentleman from a club I belonged to a few years ago, and he was an electrical engineer like you, very well educated, really nice guy. He was, I think, a third degree black belt. You know him, Tony Comfort. He competed in the Olympic trials, and like you, not quite as big as you. I think he fought 81 kilos or 90 kilos. That was it. He was at a tournament coaching some kids from our club, and one of the referees was going to have him thrown out of the tournament, said he was threatening him. And Tony, like yourself, is very, and maybe I hadn't put these connections together, maybe he feels like he has to be that way, calm, soft-spoken. And I think that's partly his personality. And they called the police on him. And it did not escalate out of control, in part because one of our other parents at the club, who is also a coach, is a police officer, and showed up and pulled out his badge, and they kind of settled it out. But I was offended. And Tony and our other coach, who is also African-American, they're like, well, you know, that kind of stuff happens all the time. And I said, no, I am not going to let this pass. And so I think sometimes people listening think, oh, well, that really sucks, but what can I do? There's two things you can do. And one is, at the time I was, I think, president of California Judo Incorporated, I raised six kinds of hell about it. I wrote a letter to the tournament director. I wrote a letter to the national organization. And I made that person write a letter of apology to our coaches. And I said, oh, we're never coming back here again. And I think maybe that's something that you wouldn't have the luxury or privilege of doing. So people around you who are your friends should be standing up and screaming six kinds of hell.
Yeah, but here's the deal, Doc. The deal is, and luckily I had my client at the time, he was an attorney and he stood up for me. But in that situation, if somebody who's white does not come in and speak up for you, you're done. Like, you're absolutely done. Like, there has to be somebody who's white who decides to step in and do the right thing at that particular time. Because it doesn't matter how much I explain, I can't explain it. Nobody is going to believe me.
Well, actually, my friend that stepped in at the time was black, but he is also a police officer, and he whipped that badge out faster than you
could believe. He has a thing of authority that the people in society accept. I'll tell you this. When I'm at judo tournaments, every judo tournament that you see me in, especially on a national level, I purposely pack blue-collared shirts because blue is a non-threatening color, and that is the color that I have to wear. I don't wear my dojo stuff. I wear a blue-collared shirt, so I appear as non-threatening as possible.
You know, I used to be a lot, I wouldn't say calmer because Mary knows that's a lie, but I used to go along with stuff a lot more than that, especially when I was starting out early in my career and, you know, being a young Hispanic woman engineer, and I would wear suits all the time that, and now I'm like, you know what, screw it, but I'm old.
We'll be right back after shout-outs to these amazing people who donated games. First, we have Samina Subhani, who sponsored an entire school. Next is Elaine Allen and Melissa Hahn, who sponsored a classroom. Finally, we have Howard Siegel and Shelley Patterson, who donated a game bundle. If you, too, would like to donate a game, go to 7generationgames.com/buy for more details.
Welcome back to More Than Ordinary, presented by 7 Generation Games. I'm Maria Burns-Ortiz, who might be able to get a word in edgewise this segment.
And I'm Anne-Maria DeMars, and we still have with us our amazing guest, Dr. Rydie Ferguson. So, Maria, you had some thoughts being spending 10 years as a sports writer on post-retirement people who are athletes. And Rydie and I this morning earlier were just talking on the phone about what do people do after the Olympics and what do people do after their sports career is over and how few of them have a plan B. Can you kind of comment on it?
Yeah, well, I think that's kind of a two-part thing. And one is definitely you see all these people who have no real plan. I think a lot of times it's the plan is the destination to get to this point, but never thinking. And I think athletes, I think a lot of people, though, because you look at a lot of people haven't really planned for retirement, but don't really have a thought of what's going to happen the day after they retire or they stop. And it's interesting, too, because I was at Gompers last week, middle school, and they were talking, you know, a lot of the kids wanted to be, I guess, professional athletes. It's what a lot of the guys were saying. They'd come up to the table and say, oh, I'm going to be in the NFL or I'm going to be in the NBA. One of the other people at the career table said to them, okay, but what are you going to do if that doesn't work out? Or what are you going to do after? And I think I would say even from middle school on up, people don't really tend to have a plan of what comes next. And I think you, Roddy, are an exception of that. You didn't just wake up one day and go, oh my gosh, it's over, now what? But it always kind of been thinking about that. And can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so my parents weren't big on the whole athletic thing. My dad was a Heisman Trophy candidate in football. He played in the NFL, World Football League, and Canadian Football League. But my parents, they didn't give a damn about athletics. My parents never missed any of my events. They went to everything, even when I was in college. But
can I ask a question really quick about that?
Yes, ma'am.
It's one of those interesting things because one thing that we've talked about, sometimes people talk so often about parents living through their kids and this is this thing. But I found a lot of times the parents who've been accomplished in sports, so who've been a world judo champion or an Olympian or played professional football, they seem to be, sometimes you get the ones that really push hard, but sometimes you get the ones that say, okay, you know, maybe there's a different route. And does it seems almost like, did your dad have that perspective? You know, I did the football thing, you do something different?
I definitely tried to play professional football. I just didn't get picked up. The Detroit Lions flew me out and they ended up not picking me up as a free agent. But to answer your question, those of us who have played sports at the highest level, we've seen injuries happen. They've either happened to us or we've watched people who are on the cusp of being great and who were just snubbed down just from an injury. My dad signed a contract with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. He was getting ready to go play for Tampa Bay and he got in a severe car accident and that's what ruined his NFL career. That is how he no longer played professional football. And I think that somewhere in the recesses of his mind, I think that was probably the compass during my rearing process, which kind of had him gear me towards academics so hard. My parents, man, I got a spanking for making C's. That's how it was in my house. I mean, not a lightweight spanking. I'm talking about a real spanking because my dad said, you're not average. We don't serve average food here. When you turn on the lights, they don't come on 75% of the time. And I'm just not going to have it. I actually got pulled off of the wrestling team. I wrestled in ninth grade in junior high school. And right before the county championships, my dad and mom pulled me off the wrestling team. The coaches were calling. Everybody was calling, coming by the house. My dad was like, I don't care about the wrestling championships. He cannot compete with C's here. And that was it.
Yeah, I did that exact same thing to Rhonda when she was trying to make the Olympic team and she got a C in biology and I kept her home for a tournament. And I got a call from somebody in Colorado Springs said, you're not keeping her home from this tournament. These are Olympic qualifying points. I said, watch her not show up. And she didn't show up, but she'd bring her grades up.
I'm telling you right now that those things for me, they're really, really important. I just believe in school first. And a lot of athletes don't do parallel processing while they're competing. I understand putting your eggs in one basket and believing in yourself and really going after and following your dreams. I get all of that. I get all of that. However, that time is going to be over. And when it's done, you have to have something. I know for a fact that I cost myself some levels of achievement on the sporting side because of what I was doing academically. But I had to. My parents weren't rich. I didn't have it such that when judo was done, I could go live back home. I mean, that wasn't the deal. I was doing my PhD studies while I was training. I was in the gym at the Olympic Training Center like at 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning. And sometimes I was going to bed at 2 trying to finish papers. I didn't have a laptop and I was in an online PhD program and I used to have to print my homework assignment out, fly outside of the country, immediately go find an internet cafe because I wrote my answers longhand on the plane with all my books. I'd go to the internet cafe, type out all my responses online, and then after practice or after the camp, or sometimes during the lunch break in the camp, I'd have to go back online to respond to my classmates or any of the questions that my teacher, I didn't have a laptop. But there's no excuse of why you can't get your work done.
When I was at the Collegiate Nationals many, many years ago, now the Collegiate National Championships, everybody's in college, right? And two people were up in the stands because it's a long break between like prelims and finals. Me and Dr. Jim Woolley. Well, now he's Dr. Jim Woolley. Back then he wasn't. And we were the two up there. Everybody else is out. I don't know what they were doing, but they weren't studying. We don't see that much, I think, focus. And like Mari said, when you go and talk to these kids, I go the same thing. I was in North Dakota at a school, and these students, I was asking them, they're high school students, what are you going to do when you graduate? And they're all saying they're going to play in the NBA. Okay, there might be one player from the NBA that comes out of a town of 100 people in North Dakota, but there's not going to be 10. And even if you make it in the NBA, this is why I push math all the time, things like contract negotiation, this is why those young kids get taken advantage of often, because they don't have the academics to read through those contracts and question them. They don't have the math to calculate, am I going to get a better deal with the percent of the pay-per-view versus a higher amount to show up? And it seems like the adults around them, whether they're parents or coaches.
Doc, the adults around them don't know any better. They don't know either. They have been stricken with the Dunning-Kruger effect. They don't know that they don't know. And what's even worse is that they believe that they do. This is the worst part. This is the thing about the whole anti-intellectualism movement and the death of expertise is that the thing that you realize, people don't understand why school is necessary. School is not necessary for the piece of paper. School is necessary for the things that you learn inside and outside of the classroom. One of the things that you learn right away is you learn how to value somebody else's expertise. Like you learn that the person who is in front of you teaching you is teaching you because you don't know. It's not that you don't know because you can't know. It's that you don't know because you have not put the same amount of reps in that they have in terms of knowing. Thus, you always know, I have to go to my teacher's office or I have to call my teacher or I need to call a TA or I need to call somebody so I can get the advice because there's an informational gap that exists here that I need to close through a human resource because you can't just go to a library and get it by yourself because if you did, Michael Jordan wouldn't need Phil Jackson. He'd just get on YouTube and practice his shot. But that's not what it is. Everybody needs a facilitator or a mentor in the developmental process. And what happens is when these people have this anti-intellectual stance, they don't believe that they need somebody other than themselves in order to figure out a problem. I was having this conversation with Chris Round the other day, who's a really sharp individual who also did judo. He said, the one thing that we understand from being in academia is that you understand a collaborative approach. You must have a collaborative approach in order to finish big quality projects. Like you have to. There's nobody who can sit in a room and do something by themselves and get something accomplished. And that's something that we just learn from the academic rigor inside of the classroom, outside the classroom, and in and out of the university setting. And some of the coaches, they're coaching and teaching, not understanding there are some weaknesses and holes that you have in your system that you need somebody else to help you plug up. And one of the major ones is making sure that these young people have something to fall back on when they finish their sport. Everybody is an injury away from retirement. Everybody's just one injury away from retirement. And anybody who's been at the highest level knows this. And those people who don't, they make an error telling these people that they can be world champs and that they can win this and they can win that. I don't care what you win. What you win is not important to me. I don't care how many medals you got. That's not important to me either. What's the most important to me is that, do you have a set of skills or techniques or things that you can pass down and give to someone else and make that person's life and their situation better? That's the most important thing. That's more important than anything.
Well, and I think when I look back to competing at the world level, what I most got out of it was the ability to stick with something for a long time, even when it's really hard. We get accolades a lot, Marie and I, for having founded this startup, and now we're going in our fourth year and we're still here, where a lot of startups have fallen. And yeah, there are days when we get up and it's just like pushing water uphill, and this, you know, this game is 99% done for the next, you know, 3 weeks. Or we go and we meet with this investor and they're interested in investing, but, oh, well, we'll get back to you. Or we meet with this school and, oh, we were going to buy your games, but we, you know, there's just so many things that can be difficult. And it's learning to do that struggle, not just day after day, but year after year. I think that's the skills that people should and could get. But it seems like, you know, to go back to Maria's question, they don't all do that. There are people like you and I that jump from being at the world level in sports and then go and get a doctorate and found a company like we both did. And then there's people that just seem to flounder.
Because they link their success to what they've done in sport. And they don't have anybody giving them any different messaging. That's one of the things that I do with my clients right now. I give them different messaging. They're not failures or successes by that which they achieve on the mat. They're failures or successes by way of their deportment in life, by their behavior, by what they're doing as an individual who has to add to society. That's most important. I don't give a damn if you throw somebody for a palm, break somebody's arm, or win the MMA championship. Those things are great. But that's not who you are. That's what you've done. And a lot of people link what they've done to who they are. And this is why athletes leave sport. They're unfulfilled, and why people contemplate suicide, and why people think about they have to do something else or do another sport or another thing, and they're not fulfilled. It's because they've linked so much of their person with their accomplishments and their achievements. And who they are and what they've done are two different things.
Well, and we're going to take a break in about 2 seconds and go to the tip segment. But since we're talking about retirement, I'm going to segue into one of my favorite personal fascinations, because you live in one of the retirement capitals in the world, Florida. And my question is, are people crazy when they move to Florida, or is it something that happens afterward? Because I think Florida is perhaps the craziest place in the world. And I just wanted to ask about that.
You know, I think the same thing about California.
Yeah, Marie does have this thing about Florida. Anytime anything crazy comes up, like guys driving down the road with his pet alligator in the passenger seat, it's always Florida.
Yeah, this week it was a naked man with machete chops down mailboxes.
Why would you have clothes on when you're using a machete? I mean, let's just use good sense here.
Because really, it's hard to find proper machete wielding clothes.
Exactly. You know, there was a woman just recently in Atlanta Hartsfield Airport that was walking around the airport naked. So this is just a couple days ago.
They're migrating up from Florida, right?
Maria, I think there's a naked movement going on, and you need to spearhead it in your location.
We'll be right back.
You know how sometimes you have an idea of how you want something done? Like how you would have your living room decorated, your closet organized, or whatever. But you just haven't had the time to get around to it, because the way it is right now is passable and it works. but in the back of your head, you know it could be better someday. Well, for Spirit Lake the game, someday is today. At 7 Generation Games, we've rolled out a major update of our very first game. We've kept the parts that were already great and enhanced those areas where we saw potential for enhancements to give you a new version of the game that we know kids will love even more than the original. If you already have Spirit Lake, check your email for the update notification. If you don't have Spirit Lake, well, what are you waiting for? Get it today. Welcome to the third and final segment of More Than Ordinary, presented by 7 Generation Games. I'm Maria Burns-Ortiz.
And I'm Anne-Marie DeMars.
And we still have joining us...
Dr. Rodney Ferguson, live and in color.
Now, this is a segment where we ask for a tip. And like I always say, the tip can be advice on pretty much anything. And from what Anne-Marie has told me and from what I've heard just of you talking, you know, it seems like you definitely aren't short of advice and tips and thoughts. So what is one tip you give people, whether it's clients or young athletes or your kids or anyone? What's one tip you think that everybody listening here should know and then go do immediately?
I think one of the most important things that we have to realize, especially in a society that is chocked with social media posts and interaction and engagement and integration, that the phrase birds of a feather flock together is more important than ever. And that doesn't mean that you're the same as the people that you hang around, but it doesn't mean that that's the perception. Even on the Latino side, we say, dime con quien tú andas y te diré quien tú eres, which is, you tell me who you walk with, and I'll tell you who you are. I think it's more important than ever for parents and for coaches and for mentors and facilitators in the developmental process to really tell those that they mentor and that they are over to pay close attention to the people who are around them. Pay close attention to not only people who are around them in a physical sense, but the people who they associate with in a digital sense as well, and even on the internet. I think a lot of young people make mistakes, especially in their youth, by associating themselves and creating digital footprints with people and things that they don't necessarily need to be associated with. And also, in terms of real people in real life, you have to make quality decisions with your personal engagements. I think that's more important than anything. And that is my tip for today.
Can I add to that? Well, I just wanted to reinforce what Roddy said. It was funny. I was thinking that exact same thing today on the positive side, where if you hang around with good people, they kind of attract other good people. And I had the opportunity to go to a lecture once that I think his first name is Harry Harman was giving. He founded Harman Kardon. He was married to Jane Harman, the representative. And he said his advice to young people was associate with people of quality. Even if you have no academic, professional, athletic reason to associate with, just because they're good people. And he gave an example of this guy who lived in his neighborhood when he was younger, who was an attorney, but he said, he was just such an honest guy, and I wanted to hang out with him. And one day he invited me over to a barbecue at his house, and I went, and he said, you know, there's this young minister that's just amazing. You have to meet him. And he introduced him to Martin Luther King Jr. when they were all young. And he said, the point is, I met Martin Luther King because I knew this attorney in my neighborhood, or I knew it was a good guy. You know, we just hired a new intern, Irma, who's fantastic. And she was recommended by Father Michael Gutierrez, who we've known for years. He's a great guy. And so I think the flip side of that is look for really good people and glom onto them, because you'll probably meet other really good people that way too.
And that's why I'm so lucky I got to spend this podcast here with you wonderful people today.
Roddy, any shout-outs you want? Where can people find you on social media if they want to access themselves of your coaching, whether it's life coaching or athletic coaching? Are you still taking new clients? Where would they find you?
Yes, I do for life coaching and for health and wellness and executive coaching as well. You can find me at www.drroddyferguson.com. That's www.drroddyferguson.com. And I have many books on Amazon as well. On Amazon, Audible, and iTunes. My books are available on Kindle, and my audiobooks are available on iTunes and Audible as well. And you can find those at coffeewithroddy.com, www.coffeewithroddy.com. I just appreciate you all, and thank you for so much for having me on and allowing me to share. I guess we ran the gamut today, everything from parenting to personal relationships. I appreciate you so much, Doc, and I appreciate the personal relationship that we've been able to kind of, I guess, develop over the years. I mean, I appreciate it. People ask me about your daughter all the time, and I tell them, I say, you know what, I know Doc way better than I know Rhonda.
Oh, and I met you. Like I said, you were graduated from college,
right, I was
and married,
man,
and she was
right.
just a teenager.
I had no business sitting around holding a long conversation with a 15-year-old.
Thanks for listening to the More Than Ordinary podcast.
For more information, please go to our website, sevengenerationgames.com. And that's seven as in the number seven, generationgames.com.
If you'd like to learn more about math and history or increase your vocabulary while at the same time having fun, you can purchase our games at sevengenerationgames.com/buy.
You can also donate and help the much-deserving student.
And as always, please tell a friend and don't forget to rate us on iTunes.
It's never too late to be more than ordinary.